You're listening to Tech Talk Radio in your backyard and worldwide on the pod.
In the communications sector, there is a revolution taking place.
Look how far we've come. A third of the music released last year in this country was not even released on the CD.
Do you use a credit card online?
No, I live in Russia.
I'm concerned about the way the company's being run and the fiber to the node network.
Unless we can have clarity that we will not be subjected to further separation, we are not in a position to lodge an RFP bid.
You can't make it a technical game because the very people who are trying to protect are smarter than you.
We want to really change the world by making things so special, you've got to have it.
On air, on the internet, and on the pod. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Tech Talk Radio. I'm Andrew McCollum. As you drive around the suburbs and towns of Australia, hard rubbish collections draw their fair share of odd television sets and computer screens. You know the ones, the old cathode ray tube or CRT displays. Have you noticed in recent times as we move towards digital television and LCD computer screens, the quantity of these devices on our nature strips is on the increase? A main component of these CRTs is lead, a fairly toxic substance which you don't really want to mess with. Currently, there aren't any national recycling programs, with the exception of a few small business incentives such as Mobile Muster. So what do you do with the old 80cm TV, which still works just fine? For years now, the nation's old television sets and computers have been tossed out and ended up in landfill. 1.5 million a year, to be precise. But soon, a new national scheme will give Australians the option of recycling their old electronic equipment. In Tasmania last week, the Federal Environment Minister, Peter Garrett, met with state environment ministers to discuss the worsening problem of e-waste. As with all meetings of this nature, the ministers agreed that there was a problem and a degree of urgency to set up what they hoped will be a national program to recycle electronic waste where possible and adequately dispose of materials which can't be recycled. Electronic waste can contain materials which are highly sought after, copper, gold and aluminium, just to name a few. There's also the issue of dangerous materials such as lead and arsenic which need to be disposed of correctly. Australian TV suppliers have proposed a permanent national TV collection, recycling and community education scheme that could be ready to roll out within 6 months. It would be funded solely by suppliers, providing there is effective federal regulatory underpinning to deal with free riders or companies indifferent to their environmental obligations. Australia needs to come into the 21st century. Government needs to regulate sooner than later, and after last week's ministerial meeting, this could be done as soon as November this year. I guess it's a start. For more information, visit reborn.org.au.
This week on Tech Talk Radio,
Adam Turner looks at the rollout of digital radio in Australia. How about storing all your movies on one DVD? China, Canada and Spain on the copyright piracy watch list. A new and improved iPhone is expected next month, and Google's new algorithm spots quitters before they resign. First up though, here's the latest happenings in the world of technology for this week with Dr. Ron.
This is Tech Talk News.
This week on Tech Talk News, a good news week for the government's NBN. E-waste is shipped illegally from Australia to China. Police breathalyzer technology fails a software audit. And Google's new algorithm helps predict when employees are likely to quit their jobs. Welcome to Tech Talk News. After a week of threats by the federal opposition to block legislation for the NBN in the Senate, the tide turned in favour of the government last week. Minister for Broadband, Communications and the Digital Economy, Senator the Honourable Stephen Conroy, told a Fibre to the Home conference last week that the government now expects the actual cost of the national broadband network to be significantly lower than $43 billion. Speaking to a conference of the Asia Pacific Fibre to the Home Council in Melbourne, Senator Conroy said a substantial contingency had been built into the element and that the government expects the cost to be offset by substantial private sector interest. Part of the contingency allows for the possibility that some NBN participants may bring existing network infrastructure to the project, reducing the $43 billion expenditure. And in another blow to the opposition, Chairman of the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission, Mr. Graeme Samuel, also spoke publicly about the proposed NBN last week. Mr. Samuel described it as the most monumentous policy initiative in the Australian telecommunications sector since the introduction of full competition over a decade ago. The comments angered the opposition communications spokesman, Senator the Honourable Nick Minchin, who accused Mr. Samuel of speaking out of turn, saying that Mr. Samuel is a regulator, not a telecommunications expert. The Age reports that illegal shipments of electronic waste from Australian homes, such as old computers, televisions and mobile phones, have been seized from cargo vessels, part of a little-known smuggling trade that fuels child labour and toxic pollution in China. According to the report, since the start of last year, 12 ships carrying e-waste have been intercepted leaving Australia for Asian ports without hazardous materials permits. Only about 4% of Australia's e-waste is recycled, with the rest going to landfill and an unknown proportion being shipped overseas illegally. A report last year by the Total Environment Centre found that about 37 million computers have been buried in landfill around Australia, along with 17 million televisions and 56 million mobile phones. The Age also reported that much of the e-waste exported from the developed world ends up in China, and that up until now, Australia wasn't thought to be a contributor to that illegal trade. An independent software firm has found bugs and software deficiencies in breathalyzer equipment used by police in New Jersey. A court case saw the source code for an Alcotest breathalyzer reviewed by an independent software firm, Base One Technologies. In a report tendered to the court, Base One Technologies found over 19,000 possible software errors, leading analysts to conclude that the software was unreliable and untested, and in several cases did not meet stated requirements. The damning report said that an incorrect breath test could lead to accidents and possible loss of life, because the device might not detect a person who is under the influence, and that person would then be allowed to drive. The report went on to say that the possibility also exists that a person not under the influence could be wrongly accused and/or convicted. Another review of the software conducted by SysTest and commissioned by the unit's manufacturer, Draeger, also agreed that the software fell below industry standard best practice and that it contained bugs. The findings have sparked debate about the reliability of such devices and the benefits of accountable open-source software versus proprietary software systems. And search giant Google, concerned by recent resignations, including that of a senior vice president and an engineering director, has developed an algorithm to identify which employees are most likely to quit, according to a report in the Wall Street Journal. Google has apparently turned to mathematical formulas because it was concerned a brain drain could hurt its long-term ability to compete. The Wall Street Journal also said that Google had examined data from employee reviews and promotion and pay histories to try to identify which of its 20,000 employees were most likely to leave. While Google officials were reluctant to share details of the formula, it had already identified employees who felt underused, which was a key complaint among those who contemplated leaving. I'm Dr. Ron, and that's your tech update for this week.
Previously on Tech Talk Radio.
Broadband advisors collect $700,000. Money well spent, boys. What do you think?
It's not going to happen. It's all just pie in the sky figures that are meaningless.
But then again, they're allowed to now, aren't they?
Everyone's allowed to do whatever
they
like. That's why Freeview is so confusing.
They send out little floppy disks to everyone in the country.
It's a massive business.
Well, they're in deep trouble with the Do Not Call Register coming to Australia for businesses and for business faxes.
Once upon a time, we used to have a word processing system called WordPerfect.
New Zealanders finally get Android.
It's heading down the path of what people call a semantic web.
But it's more a lifestyle thing.
It's a bit like the farmer in the field when they used to bury copper underneath the big high-tension power lines and get free electricity from underneath. No.
I don't think so.
Entertaining, informative and independent. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio. Panel on Tech Talk Radio.
Oh, back again. Hello, everybody. Welcome to Tech Talk Radio. Andrew McComb sitting here in the desk. Dr. Ron and Graham Callaghan are in this evening. Just to start the ball rolling. Hey, Dr. Ron, we got a real doctor coming in tonight.
Yeah, whatever. How you doing, all right?
Yeah, really, really good. Thank you very much.
That's all right.
We've got a real doctor coming in to talk about nanotechnology and DVDs from Swinburne, because, you know, they develop things down the road from our studio here. In particular, how to get a lot more on your DVD.
Looking forward to that. There's some great stuff going on at Swinburne at the moment.
So Dr. James Chon is going to join us after View from the Couch this evening to talk about nanotechnology and just how feasible and possible it is. Because this, I want to know about this sort of stuff. You know, it's all to do with the size of your particles, how light reflects off them, and what you can do. Anyway, that's not bad. A few thousand movies onto a DVD. Wouldn't you think that'd sort of fix your library, wouldn't it, Dr. Ron?
It's a lot of data to have on one disc. What if you lost it? What if you had your whole library, video library, one disc?
It's on a 20-cent DVD. You'd do dozens of them.
Yeah, you make a copy. Yeah, you just copy the movie lots of times on lots of discs.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You have the police kicking your door in and
put your entire life on one disc and then make a copy of it and put it somewhere else.
Puts Blu-ray to shame, doesn't it? Or maybe you can use the same technology on Blu-ray.
Maybe we'll ask all these questions.
Maybe
it's based on Blu-ray technology. We don't know DVD.
We do know that.
Oh, do we? All right, yeah. Well, we'll find out. We'll find out more.
Anyway,
James joins us.
All right, lots of interesting things going on in this week as well, in the media and otherwise. We'll talk about a few more later. Chick, chick, kaboom.
Oh.
Gotta get Dr. Ron going. just a big hello to Natasha Amos, who's joined the chicken mail feed of Tech Talk Radio. Gets a newsletter each and every Monday morning at around 9 o'clock. You too can subscribe to that. Just come along, techtalkradio.com.au, on the right-hand side of the webpage. And follow your nose, you'll work it out. Dr. Ron, correspondence that needs to be entered into.
There is correspondence that needs to be...
Actually, before you do
that,
can I put in a public apology? I got the names of the podcast
round. What happened?
It's nice to know people listen to the show. Thanks to everyone who emailed us in during the course of the week. When I first put the podcast up, because Graham, who normally does our podcast, he does a sterling job of it, doesn't screw it up like I do. But I got to the end of it, and I actually got the wrong... he did. And I put the wrong file name on the wrong... thing. So anyway, to cut a long story short, there's two files and they were swapped about, and if you got the music, I hope you enjoyed it. There's probably radio stations out there going, why is the show really short
this week? They got the version the podcasters usually get.
I switched it around fairly quickly, so I don't think it was too much of an issue. But apologies if you downloaded the full version of Tech Talk Radio.
When you expected the normal podcast.
It'll serve you right for being on one of those Telstra plans. That's all I can say. Dr. Ron, sorry, I've done my apologies. Yes, correspondence, Coro.
Coro, GD says, hi guys, for the past 2 years I've owned an HP iPac 5765, which had, now that's a little PDA, I think, a little handheld.
Yeah, that's right.
Digital assist, it's a little iPac, an HP iPac. This had TomTom GPS already installed on it. I've hardly had a scrap of trouble with it, and I've been patiently waiting for a map upgrade. To my dismay, I learned this week the company are no longer supporting Navigator 6, which is the TomTom version my iPac uses. So, says GD, don't buy a device which uses TomTom Navigator 6.
Yeah.
You won't get an upgrade.
Is there many of them out there? I don't know much about TomToms. Or any particular navigation devices?
I don't know. But GD's a little bit disappointed there, because the actual unit itself sounds like it's been working faultlessly. But you just can't get the map upgrade for it. So I've got a very old Navman. I'm not sure if I can get it's one of the old ICAN models. I'm not sure if I can get an upgrade for the maps on that either. If I have to buy a new unit, it's a few years old now.
Oh, well, you'll have to try and see. But then again, you know, if you've got a set of maps, I don't even have a Melways in the car at the moment. I haven't had one for years. But then again, that's just me.
So how do you find your way to places that you don't normally go to?
I use Google Maps on my phone.
In your phone?
Yeah, it works all right. That's I don't go to that many places, but it's a good option. You're not convinced, Graham.
I'm not convinced of using the phone as a navigation device while I'm driving.
No, I didn't say I was using it while I was driving. You tried using a Melways while you're driving?
Well, yeah.
Pulls off
yeah,
your
yeah,
lap and
you,
down
you
on
you
the
You put the Melways on the steering wheel and you turn it and the steering wheel together.
And the difference between looking at that and a Navman?
Well, the TomTom and the Navman talk to you. They say, you're 300 metres, turn left.
Yeah, they do.
And then people turn left immediately onto the train tracks.
And get hit by a train. Or if you're using the iPac that GD's using, it says, go to nearest road.
Driving down a road that doesn't exist, yes.
Go to nearest road.
Well, where was he? He was in a main street or something when something like that was happening, wasn't it?
Maybe.
Well, we've had a lot of road changes in Melbourne, and I presume it happens in other places around the country as well. So the maps do tend to get out of date fairly quickly.
They do. We have new roads built. We have old roads closed.
Yep.
Oh, well. There you go. You go too fast, and they're about 200 metres behind anyway, aren't they?
Oh, no.
No.
I thought a bit better than that. See, there he goes. It just goes to show what I've been using of recent times.
Yes, so. And this is the thing. The technology has been improving in leaps and bounds. The quality has been going up, the speed and the features have been going up, the prices have been coming down. They've been getting very very popular out in the marketplace, and it might be time, if you're using an older device, to just bite the bullet and get yourself something new and swish. Spend your $900 on it.
Yeah, I've already spent mine.
What did you buy with yours?
I bought a bit of interest on the home loan.
Ah, well, yes. Not quite sure that's what they wanted you to do with
that's
it.
Not the intention. Oh, isn't that's what a lot of people will be doing, however.
Look, I think it's great. Low interest rates, you might as well knock it off a bit quicker. That's what I reckon, anyway. Hey, new Turing puzzles. You know what Turing is?
A Turing test is a test that can distinguish between a human and a computer.
I know, and the computers have got so good these days that I'm finding it difficult to write those numbers that they throw at you and those silly words they throw at you these
days. That's called a CAPTCHA.
Yes. Well, the guys at Google have actually come up with a great new idea, which you think, oh, well, why didn't we think of that before? And what they're thinking of doing is putting pictures on the screen and you have to turn them the right way up. Now, think about it. That's pretty good.
Okay.
But then again, if you're thinking the other way, you could probably have a bot which tries every, But then again, if it reposts it and you've got a one in one chance of getting it, it's going to be the odds are going to be fairly hard to get the picture the right way up first time, aren't they?
Yeah, so perhaps if you've got a sequence of four pictures, they can each go four ways round. There's enough randomness there, yeah.
But don't you think that's a good idea? You could,
Well, that's one solution to the problem, yeah.
Yeah, I just think that, because a lot of these Turing tests are actually becoming fairly tricky.
Yes. What we're talking about is where you sign up for something and to test that you're a real human and not a computer. They put up some words that are distorted in some way, difficult to read, letters and numbers that are difficult to read. And the idea is that a computer text reader can't distinguish the letters between, one from the other, where one letter stops and the next one starts and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, well, I have problems doing that too.
But, as humans are supposed to be able to. But, it's getting harder and harder. And sometimes it takes, three and four tries to get them right.
I often have to click on the retry button to load a new one.
Oh, I thought that was Ubuntu.
Sometimes there's an option for people that for sight impaired users that reads out something that you type in what you hear in the speaker.
Yeah, and you wonder why that's distorted. It's because the voice recognition
can pick it up as well. Yeah.
Anyway, if people didn't spam in this world, can you imagine what the internet would be like? It'd be usable. Wouldn't it be great? You might get some of those theoretical maxes that Telstra tends to promise about with their mobile broadband and others. Not just Telstra. Don't let me single them out tonight. And another interesting thing too, which is completely non-technically related. Do you know that they're thinking about phasing out 5-cent pieces?
Are they? I didn't know that.
Didn't you? Oh, no, they are. And that poses a lot of questions. One particular one is rounding.
Yes, people are already making a killing on rounding to 5 cents.
And what does that mean for the 55-cent postage stamp?
I wouldn't imagine it would mean anything at all.
Oh, I think it'll imagine the 60-cent postage stamp.
Why would it need to change? Because you buy them on a sheet of 10 and it doesn't matter anyway.
Yeah, but what if you want to buy them individually? Well, are they going to do round down? I don't think so.
They'll do the 0 to 4 thing will be rounding down and the 5 to 9 thing will be rounding up, I guess.
Yeah, see, I rest my case.
I guess. Guessing that's what they do.
That was just one of those little things I heard go past today on the radio.
Right.
So that was really interesting.
My folks reckon when they introduce decimal currency here in our good country,
on the 14th of February,
1966, they did.
Did you find that a Wolfram? That's very impressive.
No, it was Valentine's Day, 1966. But
there was a song.
There was a song. They
before my time.
They reckon that everyone got stooged here.
Yeah.
Because now I'm going to get this wrong because I was never brought up with non-decimal currency with imperial
pounds, shillings, and pences.
But they reckon that there were 12 shillings. Is this right? 12 shillings to was 10 cents.
You're really going into an area I have no idea.
No.
And they reckon that...
Any baby boomers listening?
But you wouldn't get change. But you wouldn't get change out of something that cost 10 cents. You give them the 12 shillings, but you wouldn't get change if it was listed as being 10 cents. You wouldn't get your 2 shillings back. They hang on to it. And they reckon everyone got stooged. The government must have raked it in.
Okay.
Because the rounding wasn't clearly defined.
I see.
Mm.
Thanks, Dr. Ron. That's a bit of a history lesson here on Tech Talk Radio this evening.
Same mistakes get made again and again.
Yep. Now, let's talk a little bit about what's going on in the world this week. More evidence of the Great Australian Broadband Rip-Off.
Okay.
Do you think you're paying too much for broadband? Well, that's a good question you ask, Graham. I think, yeah.
I think we're all pretty aware of the rip-off.
There was a report done by the OECD.
Oh, yes.
There's an acronym. What does that stand for? I've looked it up.
Come
on, you boys who know about pounds and shillings.
It's not English.
Anyway.
It's not.
Okay.
Oh, it's not English.
You can't translate it directly, I don't think.
Anyway, it's the OECD report said that Australia...
Organisation for Economic Cooperation and Development.
Yeah, it's English. That's what Graham just said there. It's the Organisation for Economic Cooperation and Development.
Sorry, yeah, Andrew, go. The OECD, that the people who we were just talking about, said that the Australian broadband prices came in at an average of about $56 per month, with only Mexico at $59.50 and the Slovak Republic... It's $78 ahead of us. So does that surprise you? We are the third most, we being Australia, are the third most expensive country for broadband in the developed world.
There's probably good reasons for it when you come down to it.
Okay. I'm listening.
And I'm not saying this is a defence because we're supposed to be able to do things better in Australia than people do in a lot of other places. We're supposed to be smarter. Okay. But the defence will be that... You've got a smallish population in a very large area. We've got a tiny population in a continent the size of the United States.
Yes.
So that dilutes everything. It means you've got to spend a lot more to...
But our population is concentrated here in city centres and along the coast, wouldn't you say?
Yep, and if you start leaving people out, they start screaming. So,
oh, yes.
You know, otherwise, you know, why do we have NextG when, if by your argument, everybody could use 3?
Well, no, that's a good argument, but someone needs to provide out there, and they
do. That's right, and, yeah, so that's going to push the cost up on average. The other thing is, we're a long way from everybody.
What about Mexico? Mexico's a highly populated country.
Right, they're highly populated, densely populated, right next door to the US.
Yep.
So they've got all the advantages that we haven't.
And if we want to truck internet traffic around the world to and from Australia, then we've got to run a long way away from everybody else.
We've got to run undersea cables or buy space on cables that other people have run. It's expensive business.
Speaking of cables, Pipeworks? No, forget that. The man who's from Pipe Networks.
Pipe Networks,
yeah.
Yeah,
that's good. Where
about
that from?
They're a mob that provide interconnections between ISPs in Australia.
Their boat left Sydney last week, headed for Papua New Guinea, laying 9,000 kilometres of fibre optic, which is just going to be fantastic for Australian ISPs.
They want to plug their pipe network into the rest of the world.
And it means that the monopoly which currently exists, which Telstra has, for getting data in and out of this country, will be broken.
And
it'll give
the ISPs another option to buy that upstream data, and it'll help to bring those prices down a little bit.
Absolutely,
maybe.
Fingers crossed.
It'll still be expensive because that's going to cost them quite a bit running that cable.
Yes, but at least it might serve the purpose of providing competition on that league,
and that's the key. Good. Absolutely, yeah.
All right, whilst we're talking about internet and things like that, China, Canada, Spain are on the copyright piracy watch list. Apparently this is where the majority of copyright infringements have been done.
China, Canada and Spain.
Yeah,
Canada.
I didn't know Canada would get a gong for that, but Canada's in there. Russia.
Blame Canada, yeah.
Blame Canada.
Russia's in there as well, and they've been singled out by members of the US Congress for alarming levels of piracy, copyrighted music, movies and video games and other entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
Does that surprise? It doesn't surprise me out of China. I've seen reports on certain credible television programs where certain officials in China have said, well, that's the price of doing business in China. You get your products replicated
and there's not a culture of understanding intellectual property as being property.
That's right.
In China, yeah.
But Canada? That surprises me. Really.
Because
Canada, and I don't want to say that they're like the US, but I would have thought that...
No, I'll just say... Hello.
That's loud.
That's our Canadian listeners ringing
in Canadian
to
ambassador.
Defend themselves.
Absolutely.
I reckon that if you were a major, developed country with full of intelligent people living right next door to the United States, that you might develop a fairly strong rebellious streak.
Yes.
You might develop a pretty healthy disrespect of authority. So,
against what would you be rebelling?
Well, neighbours
domineering culture from south of the border.
Oh, that's harsh.
Well, we all know how the American movies and television and other cultural aspects permeate our lives. So,
and how that
it might be a healthy disrespect for that sort of
I think there is some healthy competition that goes on there between the two nations, similar to what happens here, I suppose, between Australia and New Zealand, and friendly rivalry.
Yes,
wouldn't you agree? JD, welcome, JD, to the program.
Good evening. How are we all?
Good. You've been very quiet.
Did you bring a note last 32 minutes?
I forgot my note. I'm sorry.
But aren't the Canadians meant to be the nice, peaceful, give up to the enemy types?
I'm are surprised. They? No, more. That's the French surrender monkeys. No,
the well, cheese-eating surrender monkeys.
Second behind the French. They just meant French in there, of course.
They do.
I always thought they were the very passive, nice people that wouldn't pirate software and be very pleasant to everybody.
The information that Andrew has in front of him says otherwise.
Yes.
Who did we have? We had China, we had Canada and...
Spain.
Spain.
Spain? Where did you get Spain from?
It was
Mexico. I had a subtle mention of pigs in there. Didn't quite catch that one with the old swine flu, but nonetheless. Canada, China and Spain with Russia thrown in for a bit of good measure. Spain was in there. They were down the list a bit, though.
Ah, right.
Anyway, so there you go.
That's not much after your rundown.
All right, in other interesting news, we've had patents left, right and centre, especially with the CSIRO in recent times. Well, Microsoft have got another one to pay. $200 million in this case. A jury in the US of Texas ordered the giant on Wednesday to pay a Canadian company for a patent infringement. Is this just like the way intellectual property goes these days with patent infringements?
Good question. I don't know.
Well, seriously, you've got to think about intellectual property. Everyone would, and you would think that the big companies, they'd be first
to
jump down.
Do we think that maybe some of these big companies try it on against small patent holders like the CSIRO might not be considered in Redmond to be a big threat, so we,
Well, hang on a minute. No, the CSIRO, they developed the technology that is Wi-Fi from they started in the war.
And then everybody jumped on the bandwagon and used it without licensing the technology.
So that's a good idea. That works really well.
Yep, they ignored the patent and just started implementing it anyway.
Ah, good on them. Anyway,
and
Microsoft.
That's what the previous case was about. I don't know what this one's about.
Microsoft copped another big whack across the...
Over what technology was it?
Pocket. Oh, I don't know. I'll have to go in and have a quick look. I've lost my piece of paper there. I'll get back to you on that. We're going to take a break.
I won't ask awkward questions.
No, don't do that. Hang on. I've got it here. but yes. I was more the point that they... Another case was really the point that I was making there. Anyway, we're going to take a break. We'll be back with Adam Turner's View from the Couch after this and a whole heap of other things.
You're listening to Australia's most informative technology show.
Talk Radio.
Police called to control crowds at a technology fair in Singapore.
The sale of Apple TVs has gone up a third in the past year.
How frustrating.
Very.
Twitter came to life like you wouldn't believe.
What next, I say?
Around about $10 billion from the NBN.
Well, that's a bit unusual, isn't it? I'm not sure what to make of that.
Those people who found themselves hacked turned into porn stars very quickly.
Entertaining.
Oh, look, Dr. Ron, I haven't seen you like that before.
Informative.
Like my old phone, is at like 32 by 32 pixels?
Independent.
Well, I smoke.
I smoke, that's right.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Don't breathe this.
You're listening. Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. Andrew McComb here, Dr. Ron, JD, Graham. Oh, look, cast of thousands in here this evening. JD, Apple. Let's talk about Apple, because there's a bit of iPhone stuff in the news at the moment. But before we do that, have you been to the new Apple shop in Doncaster?
It's Pope Catholic.
I know. A report, please. Last time you went up there with a mini disc or something like that. No, that was in Sydney, wasn't it?
Except I had my two kids and my wife with me at the time.
The kids get free food there.
Well, I don't know about the free food. I think they were waiting in the queue. But Marcus and David, my two kids, did actually get to play games on the IMAX in the little kids' centre, which was fantastic.
So what is it, multi-layered, like three stories like the other shops? So how does it work?
Single story, just very, very large. I think it's a 30-metre frontage from what I read. I didn't pace it out myself.
Yeah?
It's a big store, and it was nice and empty when I went in there. The crowd had died down by the time I got in. Lots of things to play with.
But I've got to say, nothing particularly special. I mean, it's special that it's an Apple store and they've got a
seen
genius
it before,
bar and all that sort of stuff.
Oh, they have? Yeah.
So you can go in and pose your particularly dodgy questions to them and they'll try to fix your machines in front of you, which is all good. But at the end of the day, it's just a whole lot of computers for sale and there's you can't really haggle on price there. Go down to JB Hi-Fi to do that particularly. They do training, which is good. And I know Comp Now, who are up the street, are doing the same thing in retaliation. So at the end of the day, it's just a big store.
And they're all the same, aren't they? When I say that, the model is global. It's what you get here is what you get in
the United
States.
More or less the same. They've all got a key feature. To be honest, I couldn't find out what the key feature of this one was.
Yeah.
You know, they've all got special windows or staircases or things. This one doesn't seem to have anything special that I noticed. Mm. But anyway, it was interesting, and I got to play with some new Apple paraphernalia, so that was always good.
Excellent. All right, let's talk about the iPhone, because the developers' conference is coming up very shortly, a couple of weeks away, apparently.
That's right.
The new 3G iPhone models, version 3.x,
whatever
they're going to ship it with. The only thing which I've found of interest is the fact that, obviously, we've got a bit of extra storage. And the it looks like we're going to see an OLED version, as well as an LCD version of the new
There's a few rumours out, and there's a few more than rumours out. I guess T-Mobile over in Germany, and I think it was Vodafone in Australia, happened to let the cat slip that the 32-gig iPhone's on the way and the 16-gig iPhone's on the way out. So that's sort of news.
We can snap up a bargain around here with the telcos if you want a phone like that at the moment, with the old OS.
Yeah, I would think so. So the money is that there's no mention about the 8-gig model, so there's probably going to be an 8-gig model, much the same as we've got now for the budget conscious, haha. And for those that want the latest, greatest, biggest and best, there'll be this new 32 gig version, presumably with OLED and some other nice things, forward facing camera maybe, there's been some discussion about that. And obviously the new version of the operating system coming out soon.
Cut and paste, can't wait for that.
Yeah, that's right.
Dear. Hey, the other interesting thing too, I know I'm making fun of something that's fairly serious. The Apple iPhone doubles its market share. Did you know that the sales of the smartphone grew 12.7% during the first quarter of 2009, with Apple doubling its market share? And this is according to Gartner. RIM, which is the BlackBerry people, they stole about 20% of the market and increased from 6.6 up a little bit on Apple, but obviously Apple's still a fairly dominant player in the marketplace over there.
RIM have had a good time recently in the market with the BlackBerry Bold and a couple of the new BlackBerry products that have come out. They've been gaining more and more mainstream acceptance.
The touchscreens are really taking off, I think. And you know, Apple patented all their little gadgets and things like that as well, which was all pretty good. So you know, the pinch and the flick. So watch out, anyone who tries to replicate that. They might have to chip out, talking about intellectual property and things like that before. Indeed. All right. So any other news Apple-wise, JD, this week?
I think that's enough, isn't it?
Is it? Well, there you go. Is it going to be faster, like, with these new processors?
Actually, there's a suggestion it'll be up to 1.5 times faster.
Yeah.
At least 100 megahertz faster, but presumably quite a bit faster. We've heard all those rumours about, well, more than rumours, about them snapping up people that are into parallel computing and multiprocessor cores. So I doubt we'll see that in this round, but we'll see it soon.
What about, we mentioned last week about the Atom processor ready sort of enabled devices. Is there anything there, any new light you can shed on from that point of view yet?
No, there's no buzz about that at the moment. I think the best bet there is that there might be a tablet device. They've been saying no to tablets for a long time, but then various people have been saying expect a completely new product that doesn't match anything on the market. So that sounds like a bit of a touch tablet to me. And again, covering old ground, but there was that whole patent application for what appeared to be a docking station that docked a tablet into it. So
good.
I think we stay tuned for that.
Lol, of course, if that's who he really is on our chat, says he wants the iTablet. Is that what you're talking about?
That's what we're talking about there.
Yeah. Okay. So there you go. Some of the diehard Apple guys just want their iTablet. Good concept, really, isn't it? Anyway, you're listening to Tech Talk Radio. I'm Andrew McComb. Dr. Ron, Graham, and JD in this evening. And very, very shortly, we're going to be chatting to Dr. James Chon from Swinburne, about nanotechnology, so you can hear all about how that works. And DVDs, it's just amazing
and
sort of technology.
Lots and lots of data on them.
Absolutely, absolutely. I could easily fill up a drive real quick, because I'm thinking of it from backing up data. Like, you know, I make television programs. Mm. You know how big a TV program is uncompressed? Oh, let me tell you.
Huge.
Even Blu-rays are not big enough. Anyway, let's talk a little bit about digital radio, shall we?
Oh, yes.
We're listening to the lovely romantic FM radio. You know, driving around the streets, you get a bit of flutter, a few crackles, a few pops.
Yep.
Even if you're listening to AM radio.
Behind it, yep.
Yeah, or if you're close to those nasty power lines, they make all sorts of noises and things like that. Well,
and God help you if you live in Melbourne and you're near a tram.
Oh, absolutely.
That's the noise it makes.
Is it?
Yep.
Yeah.
Especially on...
you don't have that problem, Sydney.
On AM. On antique modulation.
Yeah.
Yeah, but on FM it causes problems too.
What does FM stand for?
Future modulation.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Don't confuse people. Come on, you boys should know better. Frequency modulation.
Oh, yeah.
As opposed to amplitude.
Oh, right.
I'm not doing very well tonight with my acronym. I don't even think it's English.
Try another one.
No. We worked on OEC. Yeah.
Yes.
Anyway. Digital radio. The ABC are behind it at the moment. They're doing launches. Well, everything officially starts very shortly.
ABC are launching on the 1st of July, isn't it?
Yeah, they've done their tests.
Yeah.
They've done their tests. Adam Turner, you know him?
I remember Adam Turner, yeah.
Yeah,
Trek fan.
That's the one. Anyway, Adam's view from the couch this week is all in relation to the wonders of digital radio as opposed to digital television. Because, like, we've only had digital TV in this country for 9.5 years.
10 years, yeah.
Yeah. what chances does digital radio got? That's the question that I've got for
you. So in 2020, we'll be sitting here saying, oh, yeah, digital radio, it's picking up now. It's really good. People are starting to buy radios starting to see new cars with digital radios in them.
Absolutely. Good. Mm. Absolutely. Anyway, here's Adam's view from the couch. We'll see what he has to say this week.
I mean, all the talk about digital television, it's easy to miss the fact that digital radio broadcasts officially kicked off across Australia this month. The launch is staggered across 5 capital cities, with transmissions likely to be at low power during the evenings for the first few weeks, while possible interference with television signals is assessed. The timetable is as follows. Perth, 4th of May, Melbourne, 11th of May, Adelaide, 18th of May, Brisbane, 25th of May, and Sydney, 30th of May. It's interesting that digital radio finally launches in Australia, to little fanfare, just as Freeview launches its next big push for the take-up of digital television. Both digital television and radio were originally slated to start on the 1st of January 2001, but digital radio never quite got off the ground, despite several trials. So, of course, the big question is, why would I want to throw away my old radio and spend hundreds of dollars to go digital? Perhaps it's best to hear it straight from the horse's mouth. This is copied from the industry website digitalradioplus.com.au. The reasons are clearer sound and improved reception, extra features such as extra channels, pause and rewind radio, downloadable music, more details about the advertised product, slideshows, scrolling text, electronic program guides, updated news, sports and racing information, extra channels, which potentially doubles the number of commercial stations, tuning by station name, not frequency, making it easier to find favourite stations, and a wider choice of shows and program highlights which better meet the needs of niche audiences. Now that sounds to me like it was copied almost word for word from the digital television handbook. I admit those reasons are enough to get me interested in digital television, but I can't say they tempt me to embrace digital radio. The only time I ever listen to the radio is when I'm in a live sporting event or in the car, and the latter is only because I haven't got around to swapping out the factory CD player for an MP3 player yet. There's no doubt that radio still has a keen audience. Despite the age of iPods and podcasting, internet radio and personalised online music channels, I'm just wondering if anyone is keen enough to spend hundreds of dollars to replace a radio which is probably only used as audio wallpaper, either at home, at work or in the car. If someone really cared about sound quality that much for their music, you'd think they'd turn off the radio and fire up their CD player. If you're just listening to talkback radio, do you really need to spend all that money to go digital? For the same reasons, I question whether people will be attracted by the interactivity of digital radio. Who wants to fiddle around with pausing and rewinding? Who wants to sit and watch text scroll across a display? Radio is something that you switch on and walk away so you can get on with doing something else while you're listening. If you're after extra channels, you'll find far more specialist stations online than you ever will on broadcast radio.
What's really funny is that you can listen to all the digital stations streaming over the web from the website I mentioned earlier. To be honest, I'm more likely to do that than to switch on a real radio, although I suspect sporting events such as AFL matches won't be heard online due to broadcast rights. 10 years ago, digital radio might have been something to get excited about, but these days, I suspect it'll be lost in the background noise of the internet.
Entertaining, informative, and independent. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
We're back. Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. So what do you reckon? Digital radio? Is it going to be a happening thing?
We were talking maybe a month or so ago on the program about digital radio and were saying that it was going to be a long way off, and it was because of the television frequencies and those bands being used. But obviously the dates come forward a lot sooner than we anticipated, but Adam still mentioned...
They're still slotting it in between the analog TV channels. They're sort of sharing that little band at the moment.
That's right. Adam made specific mention there as well in his view from the couch that they were going to have to assess the potential interference between the different services.
Yeah.
So it's still very much a trial at the moment, but... If you've got a digital radio, let us know. We'd be very keen to hear what
one
your
of you
thoughts
out there that
are.
Has one.
Yeah, you can actually buy them now. We saw some in a shop in Carlton last week, didn't we?
I wonder if they're good sellers here. Because, they're over now, $100 plus.
They're expensive.
Yeah.
Is that the same as tuning your set-top box into the radio signals that ABC Dig and SBS have got running?
Don't know. Haven't
ABC tried. Will be running those radio, those Dig and Jazz and country station as well. They will be running those ones that are available on your Foxtel.
And you get them on your digital as
they're,
well. On your
they're available
box.
On the internet.
Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, and they'll also be on digital radio as well, those same channels, yeah.
Okay. Wonder what the quality's going to be like. I'm looking forward to hearing it. We're going to make some inquiries and we're going to talk to people
about
digital.
What I reckon the problem's going to be, and it's the same with digital television, is when the signal starts to fade out, so if at the moment where you go through that area where your FM radio just goes and comes back again,
mm-hmm.
you can still follow what's being said, because underneath that hiss there's still a little bit of audio, you can still follow what's going on. When that happens on digital radio, what's going to happen is that you're going to be in mid-conversation and there's going to be... And you'll pick up later on and you won't know what's been missed. Because it'll either work
like
or it won't work.
One of those big tunnels here in Melbourne when you used to drop out and you'd come out the other side and you'd miss the conversation.
But that's what'll happen is it'll work until it doesn't work and then it'll drop out completely and you'll miss 10 seconds.
Hopefully it's not based on mobile phone technology where it hands over every so often to a cell, but obviously
no.
it's not because it's
no,
out of a TV transmitter on,
yeah.
on a hill. So you're going to have a little bit more chance of lack of dropouts, really, isn't it? Because that's where your dropouts occur.
I mean, that's the thing with digital television that annoys me is that, you know, when the fridge in the next room starts up, on analog TV, you just got to click on the sound and a white line across the screen. In digital TV, it loses a whole second of picture and sound because it has to wait until the next frame till it makes sense again.
We notice that in our house when we turn the fluorescent lights off in the kitchen
and
we just get the audio drops out for maybe 2 seconds on the TV.
And it's enough to miss a couple of words. Whereas on analog, what you would have got would have been click, 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 click,
yep.
and you would have still heard everything.
Mm.
Good. Yeah.
Sorry.
Let's go there. So there are there's pros and cons.
All right. Well, anyway, coming to a radio station near you, hopefully digital radio will be kicking off fairly shortly. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Now, let's talk about DVDs, shall we? And getting as much on them as you possibly can.
But not just DVDs.
No. Well, I don't know. We're going to find out very shortly. Sitting in the studio here with us at Tech Talk Radio this evening, all the way from just a couple of metres down the road, actually. Hasn't come very far at all. We have Dr. James Chon, who's the senior lecturer, is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. Now, all sorts of interesting things, I guess, that we can talk about with you, but let's start off with, I guess, primarily, this is a pretty amazing project. DVDs, 4.7 traditionally, you're managing, according to the press release, to get a lot more, 10,000 more out of your volume, I guess. How are you doing this? How are you getting all this capacity on a DVD?
Well, I'll probably start with correcting the numbers. We have demonstrated proof of principle experiments that we could record 1.6 terabytes per disk space. And then we could increase and optimize the system to go up to 10 terabytes, which I think it equates to 2,000 DVD movies in one DVD.
10 terabytes on
10
one,
terabytes,
one traditional 4.7.
One conventional DVD.
That's correct.
That's correct.
That's
correct.
Just amazing, isn't it?
Now, obviously you didn't do this single-handedly. Tell us a bit about your team and how long you've been doing this.
We got this idea. My boss, Professor Mingu, he used to work in optical storage for quite some time. I think it's been more than 10 years now that he's been working on it. His original background is optical physics, so he was developing materials and optics for the new generation of DVDs at the time, and that was multi-layering. The multi-layering is only coming to start into the market now. You probably see double-layer DVDs and three-layer DVDs, and I've seen Hitachi and Sony doing 12 layers per DVDs and so on. So it's just coming into the market now, but he's been working on that for quite some time. When I joined his group back in 2001, I was working on some microscopy project and then moved on to this DVD project, next generation DVD. He was asking me if there is any kind of material that can respond to color as well as polarization independently to the light, then we could increase the dimensions to further five dimensions adding. So we have been using three-dimensional spatial dimensions, and on top of that, if we could increase one more dimension by color coding and the other dimension by polarization of the light.
Yeah, here we are thinking that there's three spatial dimensions and how can you have five dimensions, but you're actually, it's quite clever, so you're using color.
Correct.
As another dimension, and you're using polarization.
Now,
yes.
Anyone familiar with photography might have an understanding of how polarization works.
That's correct.
Is there an easy way to describe it? Like on the front of the camera, you can sort of like, it helps your oceans and your sky when you polarize something. Is there an easy way of displaying
it? Well, I would simply put it as that light is some kind of wave, and it is an electromagnetic wave, and anything waving has its direction of oscillation. So you can simply think of the polarization as the direction of the oscillation.
So whether it's waving by going up and down or going
correct,
left and right.
Correct. And you can rotate it by 360 degrees, and you can change the polarization as...
So when you say that's a dimension, how many extra channels can you get, in effect, by...
Well, that's the thing. I mean, we can think of making, like, 360 channels, possibly.
So every degree round
correct.
The circle,
if there is
you can
material,
put in another layer.
If there is a material that can respond and selectively in that single degree, that's possible. But our material is a little bit more than that, obviously, so...
Yeah.
We started off with two channels, so that's always a start, two by two. And then we went into three channels in polarization directions.
Okay.
We're hoping to go more than that. But that's, we have demonstrated in our paper two channels of polarization and three channels of color. And that was enough to increase it up to 1.6 terabytes.
Wow.
So imagine if you can increase like three or four, then it can easily go up to tens.
So with your three channels of light, obviously you think about the primary colors of red, green, and blue. If you push red a bit up into the infrared spectrum and you push blue a bit down into the ultraviolet spectrum, are they the colors that you're talking about, really those sort of three primary colors?
The color that we have used is we're all in the near-infrared range. So just outside of red, and then further outside, and then further
and
outside.
And just further outside,
so
yeah.
Does that mean you've got a lot more range of different colors to use as you move towards the other end of the light spectrum?
True. You can reduce the wavelength of light, and then you can go into the visible range. But the thing is that you have to have the material that
responds to it. Yeah.
Yes.
So, and that's the area that research has got to go in the future, is it?
That's correct. That's
okay.
Correct. And what we have demonstrated is using these nanotechnological marvels called nanorods, metallic nanorods. We've used gold nanorods in this particular case.
Mm-hmm.
They particularly respond to the light from orange-red around 600 to about near-infrared 1 micron.
Okay.
So that's the range that we've been working on, but... this can also go and move and shift to the visible range by using silver rods. We had a little bit of problem with the silver rods. We tried it to move down to Blu-ray, including Blu-rays and DVDs and CD range. But silver rods tend to be very unstable. So gold is very, very stable, obviously.
As in it doesn't react with other things.
That's correct.
Yeah, when it doesn't degrade.
Yes. Yes.
So we'll make the quality, yeah.
Yeah, so we've demonstrated with the golden arrows.
All right, so obviously everyone's familiar with the traditional DVD media.
Mm.
Everyone assumes that it's just a single wavelength red laser, which is what we're talking about here. So you're adding to some new product to the equation. I'm assuming, and you'll tell me otherwise, that we've got a new carrier, like a new disc with these gold nano rods in them.
Yes.
And we've obviously got a new laser to transmit these three wavelengths of light and a polarizing filter of some sorts in there.
Correct.
So I guess, is that going to be an expensive thing to do commercially down the track to make those sort of things? Or are we talking like considerably... Yes, he's nodding. Good for radio, Jay.
Well, what we have demonstrated, I can tell you, we have demonstrated in laboratory conditions, and the optical table that we have is about 3 meters by 2 meters, and it's full of optics.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and the laser itself is about 1 meter by about 20-30 centimeters wide. So it's a massive laser system. The laser system that we have used is called pulsed lasers, and it condenses the light energy in time down to femtoseconds. So one femtosecond is...
I was about to ask you. Yeah, yeah.
10 to the minus 15 seconds. So it's
That's
very
fast.
Yes, very fast and very condensed. In order to produce such kind of pulses of light, you need to have bulky optical systems.
Now, this is not going to fit in the dashboard of my car.
No.
This is not going to fit on my Walkman and it goes in my pocket.
It's so powerful.
It's not even going to fit in my notebook that I carry around with me.
That's correct. That's correct. So we've got a long way to go, obviously. The laser community have been working on trying to modularize these kind of high-powered laser system, and they have succeeded in certain way.
Is that just because the experimental equipment is big, but once you know what you want to do with it, you can make it miniature?
Correct.
Is that the idea?
That's correct. We have lots of freedom in our laser system. That's why it's bulky.
Yeah.
In fact, you've got a lot of optics to change the wavelength and change the pulse shape and all that kind of stuff, but you don't need such kind of complexity in the simple recording systems. So
right.
if the conditions are all fixed, then you should be able to modularize all of this. So hopefully, with the laser community working on them hard, hopefully we can get some modular systems.
Are the discs going to be hugely more expensive to produce in a factory? Like at the moment,
it's a crystal ball question.
Well, it just sounds like it's a much more complicated disc full of these little tiny miniature rods, instead of just being a sheet that they can stamp out of gold.
It's not that difficult, and it's not so expensive either. We have calculated the material cost, and per disc, it was only about 3 cents. Gold nanorods were made out of chemicals, basically. And
so they just put the right things in a bucket, stir it up, and they grow themselves, do they?
That's correct.
Cool.
That's correct.
That's amazing. That's really... Or like I was expecting you to say a much larger number than 3 cents a disc.
Mm.
Well, I can tell you right here. What we are doing is the process known as reduction of salts. Okay,
right.
Reduction of salts, and you may have heard it from...
This is why
I'm having bad flashbacks to chemistry at school.
You've got some positive metal ions, and you put electrons in, they become metals.
Right.
Okay. So what we're doing is we've got gold salts, and you put it into the solution, and you put some electron donors into the solution, and they give the electrons to the gold enough so that they become... gold zero with no charge, and then they start coagulating and then grow themselves. And at the same time, what we do is we put surfactants that you can find them in normal dishwashers, okay? And they stick to, because of their surface energy, they stick to certain facets of rods when they grow.
Mm-hmm.
So prohibits growth in certain direction, but only allows in one direction. So if you leave it long enough, you get long rods. If you live in short time, and you get short rods.
And I thought gold came out of the ground. How wrong was I? You can grow it these days.
James grows it in his lab.
Absolutely.
This is a very simple experiment.
All right. Now let's talk a little bit about the nanotechnology. Nano by nature is a very, very small device. How small? Like, are we talking, how many rods do you get onto a surface of a 4.7 gig disk? Like, there must be trillions and trillions of them.
Extremely many, yes. We're talking in terms of moles of rods, and one mole, it's about 6 times 10 to the 23 one mole hat can have these kind of molecules. So per disk, we calculated something like micromolar, so I would say 10 to the 17 rods inside of the disk.
That's a 1 with 17 zeros after it.
Correct.
That's huge.
That's huge. That's huge. But the size of the rods are extremely small. I mean, their widths are about 10 nanometers, which is about 1/1,000,000th of a centimeter.
These rods obviously have characteristics for reflecting the different frequencies of light.
Correct.
How do you culture that in the lab? Like, obviously, is it like a television where you have an array of red, green, and blue pixels? Or
right. We've got microscopes, basically. And believe it or not, you've got optical microscopes, which you would use in a normal medical environment. These can identify single rods by shining the light and looking at their spectrum. When they are single, their bandwidth or the color that it can reflect is very, very narrow. So by just looking at the width of the spectrum, you can tell whether they are single or double or many more.
And do they have to be put onto a disk in a certain order? Like, obviously...
No.
No?
No. That's the key part of it. The whole thing that makes it so easy is that you make different lengths of rods and... you just mix them all together and you put it onto the disc randomly.
James, you make it sound so easy. How come we haven't had this before?
Well, the chemistry method has been around for more than, I think, 13 years. And in fact, we have a local scientist who's the world expert in this. And he's Professor Paul Mulvaney from University of Melbourne. And he can make those kind of rods really homogeneously and nicely, single crystallines. So we had some collaboration with him also. The chemists have been making those rods without knowing where it's going to be used, just roughly knowing where is it going to be, but not knowing exactly where it's going to be. We were fortunate enough to come up with one application that seems like it's just a perfect answer for the question in five dimension. So, I think there are lots of nanotechnological advancements that's just waiting questions to pop up and to be used.
Mm-hmm. So, obviously, how long did it take you to get from concept through to a working model back at the office? Like, was that months, years?
Years. Like, we had this idea back in 2003. Min and I applied for a grant back in 2004 through Australian Research Council, and we were successful. We got five-year grant starting from 2005. And we had a number of students and postdocs joining this project later of that year. And then Peter Zylstra is my student. He's the first author of the paper. He joined in from Netherlands, in fact. He started in September 2005, and that's when it all started up. It took him 3.5 years to finish this project, but it finished with a bang.
Okay.
Yeah.
So where to from here? You've got a prototype which is working well. Have you recorded anything on it yet? Like, have you actually...
No, we only recorded patterns.
Yeah?
We only recorded patterns, so nice patterns that of Eiffel Towers and kangaroos and so on. We multiplexed those in a single physical layer, but we haven't actually recorded datas. And I mean, you can think of the pattern as datas as well, because they are made of bits, dark spots and bright spots and so on. They can be easily translated to data bits.
Mm-hmm.
So this can be easily translated to data bits. We just don't have an optical drive system. We have a collaboration now with Samsung to test those disks, but they have a massive system that can test different kinds of materials of data recordings and so on. So that's going on. And in fact, we've got nice results, which will be presented in June in Melbourne in a conference. But we in our lab, we do not have such kind of facility, so we have to have it in collaboration.
All right. So where to from here? You're obviously talking with Samsung, who's a fairly large player in the world of optical discs and componentry and stuff like that.
Sure.
How long will we have to wait before we see this in a shop where we can go and purchase one of these?
Sure. I guess it all depends on consumer trends. Whether consumer is ready to accept such kind of disk technologies and whether they are willing to spend such kind of lots of money to buy a disk drives and so on. At the moment, optical storage, the industry is waiting for the Blu-ray to really take off as just like the DVDs in the 90s. I don't think it has happened yet.
I'd have to agree with you on that, yeah.
It's growing, but it's not as jubilant as in DVDs. So once that goes through, and then companies start looking into the next generation, and there are myriads of other technologies lined up in optical storage technology as well. But this won't be GE obviously announced a 500 gigabytes disk. That obviously uses a different technology to ours and different technology to the current DVD drive. It uses holography.
I was reading about that today, I think. Like you're just getting used to Blu-ray, and then bang, here comes another sort of potential along the track.
Yeah.
And I guess, as you say, the consumer has to embrace it, I guess before consumers embrace it, industry has to have their 5 cents go at it and say, this is great, this is fantastic, and then put their might behind doing a commercial version of it, really, don't they?
Yes and no, but I mean, I think the consumer trend is more important. Whether people are ready to buy Blu-ray systems takes up in every homes and offices, then people, the industry will start looking into the next generation. Research and development is going to be always around. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're getting funding from government agencies, not from the industry. So we can harvest our ideas and so on. And so lots of ideas out there. So company has to really put in out of those technologies where they're going to put the monies in and resources in. So hopefully this takes off, but you never know.
James, I think there's a great need for large scale data in commercial world. Not only like I was looking at it from a selfish point of view before, because I'm involved in storing large data from a television point of view, because it takes up an enormous amount of space. You know, the applications to be able to store small DVD like devices with so much data. Like you're talking 10 terabytes a layer, I think you mentioned earlier. That's got to be fantastic for large style score and for backups and things like that in corporate.
That's what I was thinking about was backups. Yeah, even 50 gig, we're talking about Blu-ray at the moment being 50 gig for backup. That's not big enough for a backup in even a smallish company. If you've got half a dozen employees, your backups are going to be bigger than 50 gig.
Yeah.
So we're going to need technology like this coming through just for data storage.
Yeah.
Absolutely, and I guess as time goes by, we'll find more and more uses for it, because after all, you know,
absolutely,
everyone loves to record things and keep them forever.
Well, this is the thing in the industry, no matter how big the storage gets, we always find a way to fill it up. We always find something to put on it.
Look, I can give you the example. I did a measurement on my digital photo folder on my hard drive at home the other day.
Oh, yes.
24 gigs of photos. And because we have digital cameras these days...
JPEG compressed.
Absolutely. And because we have JPEGs, and because when we're in the land of digital... You know, data or space is cheap to store these things on, but yet the photos that you've got, even if they're a bit soft, a bit blurry, a bit out of focus, you want to keep them.
Absolutely.
Because they're family or whatever it is like that. And you don't have to have agency quality stills of everyone. But so there you go. I've got 24 gig and I've accumulated that in, 2 or 3 years, I suspect.
So that's 2 or 3 years worth, and you've already filled up half a Blu-ray disc.
Absolutely.
You're going to want to back this up. You're not going to want to lose it.
And I want to be able to keep accumulating and keep going so that I can give my kids a disc down the track. Here you go. This is you when you're little kids. And they've got thousands of these photos.
And last year you were using a 10 megapixel camera. Next year you're going to be using a 15 megapixel camera. These pictures are just going to get bigger and bigger and bigger.
One thing that I can probably say on that is the movie studio is definitely looking into higher resolution movies.
And that's the other thing is for actual... high-definition video but replacing film in cinema presentations.
Now there's another
phenomenal amount of data for. Huge amounts of data.
More high-def than high-def.
More high-def than high-def, 1,080 lines isn't going to cut it in a cinema.
In fact, it's going to be 4 times of that. They call it ultra-density rather than full high-definition. Full high-definition is 1080p.
Yeah.
They're talking 4 times more than that.
The next generation Bravia will come out with ultra-high-density.
So, that's another big application. And as Andrew was saying, in the industry of editing and producing television and video, you don't want to compress it into a JPEG compressed form, because... That way, every time you make a cut or an edit or you move something about, you have to decompress and recompress, you lose quality. Mm. So you want to be able to store it in a RAW format that's going to take up huge amounts of space.
Well, like
so,
RAW formats off cameras.
Exactly.
Hey, Warlock's got a question in the chat. Will it take a week to burn one DVD?
That was always the question.
How fast does it write?
Yeah. We have demonstrated, in fact, you only require a single pulse, which is like 100 femtoseconds of time to record one bit. So you've got plenty of time to really fast recording schemes. And in fact, we thinking of putting all different colors at the same time with a different polarization and so on. So we were definitely
Multiple pulses are hitting it at once.
Correct.
Yep.
Correct. So it's going to be more than gigabits per second. That's
Your CD-ROM drive is going to have a Core 2 Duo processor in it, isn't it?
Yeah.
Just on its own.
Yes.
Okay.
What sort of silly as it sounds.
No,
you could make the burners and the readers more intelligent, couldn't you, as standalone units with processors and their own memory? Yeah.
Well, I think you're going to have to go down that line, especially, and then you're going to need something to, like, you've got to feed the burner at that data rate, which it's capable of recording on too, which is... The next dilemma is that I think you need 5 years before.
So you put the burner in your network attached storage device and you just burn straight from the hard drive to the burner.
Yeah, and don't do it. It's like be like the good old days where don't touch anything when you're burning. It might.
Yeah, don't bump it. Don't put your coffee mug down.
Yeah. Actually, in fact, there's another question, speaking of bumping things. Because remember when CDs first came out, you couldn't really have them in the car because every time you went over a pothole.
I had one of those very early car CD players.
Did you?
It was lots of fun.
Oh, I could imagine. Not that you probably want this sort of technology in your car. Well, not that I can see you would want that sort of, but it's obviously designed and destined very much for a static environment where it sits on the bench and a backup sort of thing. Portability is probably not going to be it's
well, it depends how laser systems are evolving. Well, all of these things that we can talk about it, but there are obviously lots of challenges. Mm-hmm. But at least it's a starting point that the material is ready for such material, and I'm giving lots of challenges to other people, the laser community as well as the processing community.
Absolutely. Yeah. Dr. James Chun, it's been wonderful hearing all about the new technologies that we've got, because when I read about it last Wednesday when the press release came out, I thought, wow, isn't that great what you can put onto one single DVD these days, or you know, a carrier which is the same size of a DVD. It's been a real eye-opener.
And I love that this type of technology is being developed, that the basic work is being done right here in Australia.
Oh, all the good stuff comes out of Australia. As we were talking about on air with the CSIRO before and their Wi-Fi technology, another great Australian technology which has, you know, made a killing over there. So, once again, it's been fantastic, James. We'll keep an eye on press releases and things like that, and we'll see developments as they come out in due course. Thanks for coming in and talking to us on Tech Talk Radio tonight.
My pleasure.
Do you Twitter? We do. Why not follow us? For the Tech Talk Radio Twitter feed, follow TTR2008 or visit techtalkradio.com.au. to see what all the presenters are currently tweeting.
We've now got the technology, it's time to get silly with it.
Are people still using Internet Explorer?
That would be a shame.
You reckon it'll take up? I reckon the youth of today will love it.
Like a Dr. Evil's boardroom.
Yeah, it does change the way the browser behaves.
Oh, I'm excited.
Don't worry about Kaspersky. Get into your local road sign.
Yeah.
I like a fresh install, me personally, but nonetheless.
Entertaining.
I was in until you said maggots.
Informative.
How do you decide who to follow?
Independent.
Oh, aren't they the biggest crock?
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
No.
We think that we won. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio, Australia's one weird technology radio show.
Oh dear, welcome back to Tech Talk Radio, Andrew McComb. Dr. Ron!
It was terrific having a real doctor in the house for a change, wasn't it?
Did it make you feel somewhat diminished?
Well,
we know where you got your doctorate from.
James is a very, very clever man, isn't he?
Absolutely.
Isn't that great, the work that he's doing?
And very passionate about what he does, too. Like, I learned so much in that last, you know, 20-odd, 30 minutes, which we just had. But I think the possibilities are endless for that type of storage, especially as we were discussing later in the program there, and backup.
Yep.
The world needs backing up.
And
I do.
It's great to hear about the baseline technology behind it as well.
Yeah.
And adapting other technologies to work together, the crystalline forms and so forth.
And just, I thought he would have, because it was, you know, they're using light, I thought, oh, they've probably gone right from one extreme of the spectrum to the other. Mm. But no, it's all in the infrared. I found that to be amazing. I thought, oh. Because blue, obviously, down around the Blu-ray area, where Blu-ray is, but, you know, that's a
smaller wavelength,
different technology in itself. And yet they've gone the other way, away from the blue, which obviously, look, we could probably talk about that for ages and ages, but I suppose we should move on, really, shouldn't we? But thank you very much to James, who came in from Swinburne, just down the road from where we're broadcasting from, so not all far away. Hopefully we'll get him back again. We'll do something else.
That'd be great.
Other things. Mass storage and stuff like that. That'd be great. Twitter. We talked about Twitter. We're all very big Twitter users, aren't we? Some of us. Some of us not. Some of us are.
Occasionally.
Very small Twitter users, yeah. Yeah, there's been a lot of rumours and speculation around in recent
times. Oh, no, they're not selling
again,
are they?
About advertising.
Advertising.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Advertising. And there's been a lot of speculation. And it's Stone, Biz Stone, who
he's the founder?
He's one of the people who run
the
show.
One of the boss fellas, yeah.
Basically said that Twitter could monetize their ads, if they choose to do ads, and other methods known as in the microblogging service, but they haven't really come up with anything yet, which is going to say what they're going to do.
They've got to do it in a way that, you know, if they just start tacking a huge ad on the end of every tweet, then the users are just going to leave in droves.
Well, yes, that's right. And I think the other thing, too, is that they need to do it, you know, on a web basis, not so much in the tweet itself, because the tweet's limited by the characters, because, after all, it is microblogging.
And if you fill it up half with an ad, then what's the point?
Yeah, well, you see, there's a couple of services. TWE2 is one, which is a SMS service which retweets your Twitter feeds, and they do that. They reserve the last, you know, 40 characters or something for a bit of an ad. I think at the moment they're just advertising themselves, but that's what they're doing. And I guess Twitter's no different, because at the end of the day, you've got to make, these guys have to make something from their all their IP that they've put into building such services. You look at Rupert Murdoch, for example, when he bought, was it Facebook that he bought? One of those big, huge at the time, social networking sites.
Hasn't it was made MyFace, wasn't it?
MyFace, MySpace, yeah. That's the one. Hasn't made a cracker on it. In fact, it's been a loss-generating issue for him, because as soon as you go putting ads on those sort of things, everyone just leaves in droves.
I think Twitter left the last 20 characters off the message so they could put the little at symbols and the usernames and things, so they could put like control information there. Yeah, because the universal standard for text messaging is 160 characters. And they've said, well, we're going to reserve 20 characters for our own sorts of things. The one thing that Twitter is looking at as well is that maybe targeting businesses and enterprises, saying that we can actually introduce business-style services using Twitter technology and Twitter-type communication systems.
That'd be
systems.
Smart, in place of SMSing between your staff members.
That sort of thing. And we'll charge you a small amount for it. And as a business, you'd say, yeah, well, I'll pay for that. That's okay. That's a good investment. But keep the system, keep the Twitter service free for everyday users. And I think that's probably the direction that they're going to head in, which is good.
They're also looking at doing some tests of text advertisements on the homepage. You know, how you have your own homepage on Twitter. Mm-hmm. They're looking at doing that. Also, footer ads, which is what we were talking about just now. And obviously, there's another one which they're looking at doing in search. So, you know, when you do a Twitter search or something like that, maybe you end up on a page which is very much theirs.
I think having,
and they can throw some ads at you.
Having some not too intrusive ads on the web page parts of it is not going to offend anybody too much. People are used to that.
Oh, we've all got Adblock Pro.
Adblock
Pro. Oh, look, it's the best application for Firefox, the best plugin I've ever come across. I think Adam Turner put me onto that. It was excellent. But anyway, yes, you're right. But these guys need to make some money somehow, and if they can do it, well, all good for them.
Yeah.
So, all right. Now, other interesting things this week. Dr. Ron, you mentioned this last week, and I thought, isn't that funny? Isn't that timely that it came out in the news at the same day? Who am I talking about? Being in beta is cool. So cool that 5 years after its April 2004 launch, insert mail service here, is still in beta by insert big company.
Would that have
company
in the world?
Speaking of Google, Gmail still in beta.
Yes, in 2004. It's now, what are we up to now? 6 years down the track, five and a half, 6 years down the track. Gmail is still in beta.
Really? Do you think they might be close to getting a release candidate together, or?
Are they even bothering? I don't know what they're afraid of. I don't know why they're keeping the beta tag there. It's quite odd for Google. There's so many things that Google do which are released and are stable and everybody's using.
I think it's really impressive that a company that has 146 million users worldwide of Gmail, and it's still a beta product. We haven't proven it yet. Hello?
They're worried about the capacity issues, aren't they? Yeah.
My experience is that it's very usable, it's very stable, and it's very reliable
but
for most of the
time. But
why
is it still in beta? Is their method to their madness?
I don't understand why they're promoting it as still being in beta. Mm. It's quite odd.
Maybe they're not happy with it.
No, but even still, you look at what Gmail does now. It's basically a repository. Everyone can throw things at it and keep archive your mail there. You can IMAP in, you can pop in, you can pull things down off the system. It shares contacts with your PDAs and your mobile phones. It does everything. It's still in beta. anyway, it is pretty amazing. So and there's a lot of other products. Let's not stop just at Gmail. There's a lot of other things like Google Docs, for example, which is still in beta.
Okay. There's Google Docs feels like it's still in beta, though. It's not a polished product. It's still got bits and pieces here and there where you can upload stuff here and download stuff there, and that might work, and you're currently restricted to these file sizes, and you're currently restricted to these file formats.
Obviously a user of Google Docs.
Well, I've used it, and I've thought, yeah, well, that's okay. If it's a beta product, they're still testing, they're still getting their head around how the product is actually evolving for them. But Gmail, come on, as you say, it's used by millions of people worldwide.
And 146, to be precise.
Yeah, and it's been around for a long time.
So, all right, what about Google Calendar and Sites? I use those.
I use Google Calendar. That's very polished. That doesn't need to be in beta if it still is.
Google Calendar syncs with all your PDAs. You can even get third-party applications where you can sync your Google Calendar with your Microsoft Outlook.
And they give you free text message alerts in this country, certainly.
Do they?
Yeah,
I've tried that.
For upcoming appointments, you just click the SMS alert box.
Oh, good. Just what I need. My phone going off and an SMS all at the same time.
You do have to sell your soul and give them your mobile phone details. They can send a message through. But that's okay. And it doesn't cost a cent so far.
Okay. So anyway, I just find it amazing that a company of the ilk of Google has the repertoire of so many beta products. It's just speechless. But anyway, what next, I guess, for the big giant of multinationals? Well, speaking of what's next, Chrome.
Chrome 2.
Chrome 2 came out during the week.
Now, they're pushing Chrome more and more, haven't they? Have you noticed on the Google search page on their main Google.com and Google.com.au?
You can't miss the bit that they're saying it's 8 times faster than IE8.
No, exactly. They've been putting a whopping great big Chrome icon in the middle of the page of the last few weeks, haven't they? Saying download Chrome now.
Have you got it yet?
It's not on mine. It's because I'm already using it.
That'll be the reason
you're using version 1 or 2.
I'm actually using version 1, but yes.
And Google Calendar is in beta, Andrew. You're right. So
But yes, update your Chrome to version 2. Apparently it's a lot faster. It still doesn't like Java. It's one of the tests that I've been doing. So I reckon, despite the fact that Google Chrome is not in beta, it's actually up to version 2, a few bugs to iron out in it. Get your Java working properly, Google, and we'll see what happens. Like, for example, if you go to the Tech Talk Radio webpage and you want to see Adam Turner's view from a couch about Star Trek, which is a video, that's all Java-based. Mm. And no, it doesn't work for you. You have to use one of the other browsers to go and have a look at it. So there's little bugs that they need to iron out. So they should maybe this Chrome should be still beta Chrome, based on what they do incredibly well. All right, we'll take a break, I think, when we come back. What are we going to talk about?
Oh, we're going to talk about GPS systems breaking down, satellites falling out of the
sky.
Hang on,
we haven't got that much time left. We've eaten time in other areas, Dr. Robert. We'll try our very best.
Okay.
What I do want to talk about, too, is the algorithm to see who's going to be leaving the office shortly. I reckon that's going to be great. A couple of satellites had a bit of a faux pas in space.
It really shouldn't happen.
Hello!
We're a pure communications vehicle, and we have a couple of multi-skillable vehicles.
What tracks space junk?
NASA do.
Do they?
Yeah.
The panellist formerly known as...
No, it's not the mobile's cup of tea.
Entertaining.
It's a three-day love fest.
Informative.
Imbeciles in charge of email.
Independent.
Maybe that sort of technology could be useful.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Yeah, there and we trust.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
You are. Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio in the last little bit of the show for the evening. You're listening to Dr. Ron, Dr. Graham, and Dr. JD sitting on the other side of the bench. And hopefully, what are we watching on Ustream tonight, boys? Just the studio, general.
We just had the studio. We've had a bit of camera trouble tonight.
Had a technological failure.
We've had a catastrophic failure. Goodness, we've got powered USB hubs here. We've got cameras and power leads.
This is what we go to show what goes on here in the studio.
It's all getting too hard. We need to be set up permanently like this, don't we?
Oh, heaven forbid. All right. Let's one other thing that came across the news desk during the course of the week, which I thought was quite interesting, was the 10 most disappointing technologies.
Yes.
Now,
yes.
I don't know whether
you've
seen... Well, there was two honourable mentions. One honourable mention was for biometrics, which was supposed to be a magic bullet that solved our security needs, you know, retinal scans and nothing.
Fingerprints and things?
Yeah, nothing's really, apart from the fact that I can log on with my fingerprint on my little laptop these days, it's probably about the only thing I've really seen, and I don't know, there's not too many incidents of people having their right index finger cut off or their eyeballs taken out for security reasons.
Well, I do it in the movies all the time.
Absolutely. Doesn't James Bond do it?
Yeah.
So there's biometrics. The other honourable mention was Ubuntu.
What's bad about Ubuntu?
Thinking about this, boys, no doubt going to catch some flack from this one, when I read it, I thought, yeah, you will. But deep down, even the hardcore evangelists will agree that Ubuntu has thus far been something of a disappointment. While Linux has definitely caught on in the enterprise server and database markets, the open source OS has never really been able to move into the greater market.
Adam Turner in our chat room says Ubuntu was a big call. I've been trialing Ubuntu for some years now, since version 6.06.
Graham's an advocate for it, I would have thought too, aren't you?
Well, yeah, Linux, but not Ubuntu. Yeah, I haven't been.
What's the difference? I don't use either. To explain.
Ubuntu is one distribution of Linux operating system. And there are others, and the one I tend to use is others.
It's like having Windows Small Business Server and Windows CE and saying, what's the difference? Yes, they're manufactured by similar people in a similar vein, but they're designed for different environments.
But it is a big call. I mean, Graham and I both played with Red Hat when it was first out very, very early in its days. I played with Yellow Dog for the Mac back when you needed to do that. And now with Ubuntu. And I've got to say, Ubuntu was the easiest to install, which you'd expect for a third or fourth or tenth generation Linux platform, but I thought it runs quite nicely and installs pretty easily. So
yeah, but none of the Linux distributions can quite cut it as the average user's desktop, because you can't do as much with it. You know, you get a new printer and you get drivers for Windows and Mac. You get a webcam and you get drivers for Windows and Mac. Yeah, you go and buy a accounting package to run your business on it, and it runs on Windows.
And it's got a Windows installer. And that's
that's what's stopping it. You just can't quite do everything with it.
So really the market hasn't embraced it as an alternative operating system, is that what you're saying? And how different is it, though, from the basic, you know, core elements of Windows and Mac? Like, could Ubuntu use, and I don't know whether there's intellectual property issues here, but could Ubuntu use a Windows driver or something like that to make a device work, for example? It doesn't work like that?
Doesn't work quite like that. There are ways to run an emulator to run a Windows program on it, but that doesn't always work all that well either. There does need to be programs written, or at least if not written, then compiled and released specifically for it. But, it's...
It's just not quite there.
That's right.
It's so close.
I see what they're saying about the honourable mention of technologies didn't quite get there. And now you've explained it well.
In the other side of the world, if you're running a web server or a mail server in a corporate environment, quite often it's going to be a Linux server running possibly not Ubuntu, which is geared towards the other end, but maybe Red Hat or Fedora, which is the distro that I tend to use a lot more.
Well, and those systems work extremely well. They're very efficient.
They do an excellent
job.
And there's no licensing fee, so it's a real turn-on for businesses who have large-scale deployments to roll out.
In some cases, it's still a commercial product. So if you go Fedora, you get a totally free product, no license fees, as you say, but you don't get any support. If you buy Red Hat Linux, you get the full support of Red Hat behind you. If you've got a problem, you ring them up and they'll fix it. And
that's the difference between buying the different distributions of it. Is the level of support that you might get from an organisation?
Yep. Sometimes that's the difference. And so, even though the operating system itself is free, you might still pay a company to provide you with a distribution that's supported.
Okay.
So, but then what you pay for is the support.
Now, it sort of cuts across the whole Apple discussion, though. And I know we're looking for things that are easy to use out of the box. But if you read what your version of Linux requires and you buy what it requires, it works.
Yeah, it does, yeah.
If you want to go and buy the cheapest thing that's just been released from Taiwan, it probably won't.
Mm.
But that's not unique to Linux.
No, it's not. And Ubuntu has really concentrated on making things just work in that sort of way. You install it and you've got a working web browser, you've got a working mail client, you've got a working word processor.
Yeah, office application type suite.
Yeah, and if that's all you're doing with your machine, if you're just reading email, browsing the web, writing up a few spreadsheets and writing a few letters.
Maybe listening to some music, yep, works very well.
Yeah.
I've got 10 other disappointing technologies to get through here.
All right,
sorry.
5 minutes each.
But you have explained it exceptionally well. I think that was good. Here we go, the top 10 disappointing technologies. Virtual reality sits in at number 10. Number 9...
Well, that never happened.
No, exactly. Ah. Exactly. Number 9 is alternative search engines. Why compete with Google? But then again, whoever wrote this hasn't caught up with Wolfram yet. I played with Wolfram after you spoke about it last year.
Is it? Information concentrator.
Yes, that's a good way of putting it. It's like an aggregator. It brings all those information things together. It's mathematical. It's some of the things you can do.
You even listen to last week's show, Graham.
I was just thinking exactly that.
WolframAlpha.com.
Yeah, go with that. And then think of something scientific to put in. We should have actually put it to James when he was here. If you go and put in red plus yellow or red plus orange or something, it can calculate colours, gives you the hex information. You go and type in what was the weather like on such and such a day. If the database is there, it'll pull it in. What was the weather like on your birthday? All that, and you can mix things like shares and stocks and scientific formulas, and it does graphs and... it's amazing. But anyway, Wolfram Alpha, go and have a look.
I will.
Link
in the chat room.
The number 8 top 10 disappointing technologies, number 8, is voice recognition.
Yeah, it is disappointing.
Yeah.
Voice recognition is just, that's another one. It's just almost there. It's almost really, really usable, but it's
we had a guest
so
talking about that not so long ago.
It's processor intensive, it's so memory intensive, and
it just
even
doesn't
when it's,
work if you've got a Russian accent.
No, it wouldn't.
Oh, yes, you've been watching too much Star Trek.
I was going to say Star Trek reference.
Yeah, it's very funny. Number 7 was Apple Lisa. Now, I've never heard of this. Have you?
I have several of them at home.
You're kidding. Yeah. What is it?
It's the precursor to the Macintosh. So it's actually the first widely available graphic user interface computer. So there was
really?
There was the Xerox...
And it never kicked. It never took off.
Well, it did. It was just very expensive. There was the Xerox Star that people probably remember, those that are into computer history. And then there was the Apple Lisa, which outsold it significantly.
Mm-hmm.
But they were frightfully expensive. In 1982, 1983, they cost $10,000. Back then, people weren't that interested in personal computing. They didn't quite understand it. And they certainly didn't understand a mouse and a GUI. So then the Macintosh came out significantly cheaper, and the Lisa got killed off. The interesting technology development was developed by committee. So they went out to the users and they said, how do you want this thing to work in an office environment? So it was committed to death rather than the Mac and Windows and other operating systems since, where people have said, what do I want it to do? What would be fun? Let's put some gadgets in there, like some cool games and a clock and those sorts of things. Which the
a
original
calculator?
All those sorts of things.
A notepad?
Yeah. Which the Lisa actually did have. Yeah. But it didn't have cool stuff in it. So it didn't attract people.
The calculator's pretty cool.
What about
the reverse Polish one, maybe?
What about cut and paste? Did it have that?
It had multi-threading, it had multi-processing, it had a whole lot of stuff, but it was just way too early.
Okay, ahead of its time. Number 6, 10 gigabit Ethernet.
10 gigabit Ethernet?
Yeah, 10 gigabit. The fact that...
100 meg all the way, baby.
Yeah, cool. Number 5, another big disappointment in the technological stakes, is FireWire. USB sort of Gesamtus?
USB 2 ran almost as fast.
FireWire 800 is faster again, but we won't talk about that, will we?
FireWire was a Mac thing, wasn't it?
It's an IEEE standard that Apple happened to implement.
And they did it first.
Hmm.
Okay, cool. Well, that's where that comes from.
We still use it. FireWire is the thing that gets your DV camera. It connects, it sucks all the data out of your DV camera onto your computer.
Yeah, that's about the best it's used for these days, if I recall.
That's right.
Yeah.
And it's very good at connecting up hard drives to servers that you actually need to be connected to. USB drives tend to fall off, but that's another story.
Yeah. other technology that never quite got there in disappointment stage, number four, Bluetooth. Do you think Bluetooth is a failure?
No,
today.
I think Bluetooth's a resounding success for it.
Use it every day, yep.
Yeah, good.
Designed to do something that it is not now doing.
Yeah,
that's where they're coming from.
Maybe near wireless, near field wireless communications.
How many people use Bluetooth keyboards and mice? Lots of people do.
Yeah, I think it's just the mobility factor.
I use a Bluetooth mouse with my computer. I use a Bluetooth car kit in the car all the time.
Yeah, so do I.
Yeah, okay, they're wrong on that occasion.
Mm-hmm.
Itanium. When the Intel rolled out the Itanium, the company thought it had a server platform for the foreseeable future, but unfortunately they didn't.
No one actually wanted one.
No one actually wanted one. Number two, the Microsoft Zune, the biggest flop since...
Yep.
I don't know when, but...
Microsoft tries to do an iPod, yep.
In fact, Microsoft actually take the cake for number two and number one. The number one of the top 10 disappointing technologies...
Windows.
Yeah, got it in one. Windows Vista.
Windows Vista. Windows in general.
No. Windows Vista. So
Zune had so much potential as well, because that was one of the first music players that had Wi-Fi in it, one of the first portable music players to have Wi-Fi.
And then it was crippled.
Yeah, when we heard that, we thought, what a fantastic idea. We can share our songs really easily.
No.
We'll be able to browse wireless networks, and we'll be able to copy stuff across from our server.
No.
Ba-ba. Right. It hasn't ever even been officially released in Australia, I don't think, has it?
No, I don't think so.
You can only buy it on eBay if you live here. If you want to buy one.
Yeah, don't bother.
Don't bother.
All right, there you go. That's the top 10 disappointing technologies according to Sean Nicholson Thompson. So there you go, on one of the journals recently. We were going to be talking about now Google's algorithm for spotting quitters before they resign, but we're going to have to carry that over to next week because we're out of time.
Suffering succotash, this has to be the best technology show on the internet for Tech Talk Radio.
Let's face it, Telstra has a huge PR problem.
It's called the Integrated Public Number Database.
Hopefully that's not what they're talking about.
No.
You block them, do you?
I do.
Yeah, this is what happened, yeah.
This is what happens.
Yeah.
Look at that.
Yep.
Good use of technology.
Adam, you're too far gone to be saved now.
Entertaining.
How can you work in IT and not drink coffee?
Informative.
Often are you techie propeller head, Vicky?
Independent.
So SMS is not an on-time delivery system.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
And if you get Inga from Sweden showing her wares.
In this house, we'll be the lords of thermodynamics.
Tech Talk Radio, gadget of the week.
Have you ever had to do a PowerPoint presentation or an Impress presentation? And you've had to lug around a big data projector with you so you can put your PowerPoint show up on the wall.
Yeah,
I've done that.
How annoying. BenQ have developed the GP1 LED pocket projector. This is a palm-sized LED projector. How good's that?
That sounds excellent.
The following
palm sizing.
The following review is actually available for everybody to read on Engadget. The universal acclaim for BenQ's GP1 LED projector is deafening, says Engadget. Naturally, some trade-offs have been made with brightness, contrast and resolution in order to squeeze things down. But at just £1.4, it won't cause your bicep atrophied by panty waist netbooks too much strain. Thanks to a LED light source with 20,000 hour lifespan.
Wow.
It's worth $499. It manages to spread 100 lumens across 858 by 600 pixels with a 2,000 to 1 contrast ratio. That's pretty good.
Lumens. It's not bad.
100 lumens.
So when you think about those globes and some of the projectors, they're the expensive parts to replace too.
Yeah.
So is that available in Australia?
It's everything's available in Australia, Andrew. The review says that BenQ's come up with a winner. And truth.
So check your local retailery sort of thing. Well, and for the BenQ, all right.
Yeah. There you go. So the gadget of the week: GP1 LED pocket projector.
Here it is, everybody. The world's greatest website.
Tech Talk Radio website of the week.
I've got this one. This is one I came across during the course of the week. Have you ever, one that you guys probably, Dr. Ron, maybe you're a social networking fiend. You have many different avenues to vent on, haven't you? You're a Facebooker, you're a Twitterer, you're a
blog.
You can blog.
Yeah.
What would I say if I found one aggregator which is pretty good? I won't say it's brilliant. I won't say it's ordinary, but you've got to go and have a bit of a play with it.
Another one.
Well, and this one's called Streamy.com.
Streamy.com.
Now, I went and had a play with it during this afternoon, and Brian from the office, he was having a play with it too. Now, he's more of a social network. He's the gen that does social networking.
Oh, really?
Now, he was suitably impressed when he first started logging in and playing with it and seeing how he could share all of his stuff and use widgets as opposed, you know, so you can drag widgets around the screen of different sort of things.
Oh, yeah.
Well worth a play, but he sort of said, yeah, it's got a bit of work to be done on it yet, but the actual concept is really good.
So this sort of combines all your statuses from all your different...
Yeah, when you do a tweet, it tweets on everything, pardon the pun, it goes out on your Facebook and all those other sorts of things and search and find, and your instant messaging and your Google Talk and all that sort of stuff can all come in, everything you can think of.
I'll have a look. I'm trying to get my head around friend feed at the moment.
Yeah, there's one too. Streamy.com is the nature of the beast. Have a look.
There is a fine line between genius and madness.
That's just by that much. I know nothing. Nothing.
Don't ask! For God's sake, don't ask!
Houston, we have a problem.
The Odd Spot on Tech Talk Radio.
Hey, have you ever accidentally clicked on something on eBay and purchased something that you didn't mean to?
Oh, like a tractor or...
Like a big tractor or something?
I'm right for them at the moment.
When most three-year-olds go shopping, they're happy if you buy them a doll. But a young New Zealand person, P.P. Quinlan, got onto her parents' computer, let her fingers do the walking, and her parents let themselves log in eBay. She ended up buying a $20,000 Kobelco earth-moving digger.
It was a nice-looking tractor.
It was a very, very nice tractor. The toddler, who usually prefers high-heeled pink shoes over giant yellow and black diggers, had woken early and started playing on the computer while her parents were asleep.
So you never save your passwords to those sort of things.
No.
Just a lock mess.
A couple of
hours
of the
story. Computer. Yeah.
There you go. I think the site actually allowed them to... Yeah, they didn't,
excellent.
Didn't hold them to the $20,000
transaction. Well done. We're going to go. We'll do it all again next
week.
Hey,
happy birthday, Graham.
Oh, happy birthday, Graham.
Thank you.
That was a good secret. Yeah, okay. Till next week.
You've been listening to Tech Talk Radio, brought to you each and every week by a group of dedicated professionals from within the media, broadcasting, IT and telecommunications industries. The team consists of executive producer Andrew McComb, producer Dr. Ron, panellists Justin Dunlop, Graham Callaghan and Mark Diggins. Expert opinion from Adam Turner, and our US correspondent is Lydia Davis. Post-production facilities courtesy of Evolving Communications. Podcast production by Graham Callaghan. Tech Talk Radio is broadcast, recorded and streamed live to the world each and every Monday night at 8 p.m. from the studios of 3WBC. The crew wish to thank all the stations around Australia that take the show. Tech Talk Radio is available for syndication on your local station. For sponsorship and advertising, call 03 9818 2756 or visit our website techtalkradio.com.au for more information. This has been a production of Tech Talk Radio Vic and is subject to copyright and applicable laws and may not be rebroadcast without approval.